Today at Reader's Corner, Mary Ellen Hannibal, author of Citizen Scientist, Searching for Heroes and Hope in an Age of Extinction. In our complex and data-driven world, scientists face a major challenge to understand and document plant and animal species that may be in the process of disappearing. Climate change, habit fragmentation, pollution, and population growth are among the threats that are pushing some species toward extinction. The good news, and we need some good news these days, is that overwhelmed researchers are getting an assist from a growing number of enthusiastic volunteers. Known as citizen scientists, these volunteers are using their eyes, ears, and observations about the natural world to help scientists find answers to critical questions. Mary Ellen Hannibal counts herself as a citizen scientist, and she's written a book about this fascinating subject called Citizen Scientist, Searching for Heroes and Hope in an Age of Extinction. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Ms. Hannibal. She is an award-winning author and journalist and a media fellow at Stanford University. Citizen Scientist was named a best book of 2016 by the San Francisco Chronicle. Ms. Hannibal was a guest on our show in 2013 to discuss her earlier book, The Spine of the Continent. She joins us by Skype for this interview. Mary Ellen Hannibal, welcome back to Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much, Bob. I'm really happy to be talking with you today.
Well, let's start with the basics. What's citizen science?
Well, thanks for that. Citizen science is a general term basically meaning regular people, people without a credential necessarily, contributing to scientific research. And it can also be scientists contributing in fields outside their expertise. So it actually has a lot of different kinds of definitions. But for the purposes of most of us, it's really about being able to go out and participate in a project or using an app that is connected with a vast database and have your one single observation of nature, a bird, a butterfly, a bug, a mammal, become part of a much bigger picture. And as you mentioned, you know, we're in this crisis today with plants and animals going extinct at the rate and magnitude that took out the dinosaurs. We're also seeing something else which is arguably worse, which is the vast reduction of bodies of wildlife. So several recent studies have shown that we have 1.5 billion fewer birds on the whole planet than we did in 1970. And that there's other statistics for vertebrates and marine animals. Now, the thing about that is this is where we can really make a big contribution because, you know, we sort of clue into extinction as the polar bear on that melting ice floe or the African elephants. But in fact, you know, nature is in trouble in our own backyards, in our regions, in our counties, in our states. And this is where we can really make a huge difference. So you might just, you know, live in the suburbs or in a city. I live in San Francisco. Or you might live in a rural area, but if you make observations of nature, and the smartphone makes this very easy, although you don't have to use a smartphone, and you give your data to some databases that are in functioning all over the world, you help create a picture of the patterns of these animals, this biotic life, and that helps us see what's happening to them where and make some conservation interventions.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned how accessible the work of a citizen scientist is today. As I was digging into your book, I ended up on the internet a couple of times following your leads. And my question was, what's going on in Idaho? And I came up with Al Larson, who is known as the Bluebird Man. And here's a guy who, when he retired, decided he was going to build nests for bluebirds. He's banded over 27,000 bluebirds in his career. He's 95 years of age. They did a documentary on him that's called The Bluebird Man, which was done by Wild Lens Incorporated. In fact, if people want to Google Wild Lens Incorporated, they can watch the documentary. But it's just such a perfect example of a citizen scientist, a guy just deciding, he and his wife Hilda, by the way, co-founded the Golden Eagle Audubon Society, which is the Idaho chapter of the National Audubon Society. And I think it works right into your book as an example right here, as you said, locally, of something, some impact an individual has made that is really significant when it comes to the bluebird population.
Well, that's a wonderful story. And, you know, the history of citizen science, which, by the way, goes way, way back. I mean, Charles Darwin was a citizen scientist. He had no advanced degree, and he worked only for himself. Thomas Jefferson was a citizen scientist, and he basically trained Lewis and Clark to be citizen scientists. And when he sent them out to the West, he told them to make note of the plants and animals he saw, they saw, and to note when they were blooming and what their life cycle was. But this bluebird person that you're talking about is what, you know, there's a category out there of these super volunteers who just do this, you know, above and beyond even what any scientist really does. God bless those people. It's fantastic. So here's something to point out. You know, if he did this bird banding project, then there's a whole bird banding protocol. And so you get bird bands from the U.S. Geological Survey. And so they keep track of the numbers that are on those bands. So there's a single repository for bird banding data in at least the country, it might be in the world. Mm-hmm. And this is a key thing that when you, if you have a desire to do citizen science, you want to connect with something that already exists, and that's through a place like the U.S. Geological Society or the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. I'm sure that he was is connected somehow with Cornell because they do so much bird citizen science. Then, of course, one of my favorites is iNaturalist. And iNaturalist is something you can sign up for on your desktop or right on your smartphone, but you put the app on your phone. And with iNaturalist, you make an observation of nature, of a bird, a bug, a butterfly, and the app assigns that photograph the date, the time, the latitude, and the longitude of where you took that picture exactly when. And that's really what puts the science into the observation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a big question that always comes up about citizen science is how can we trust citizens to do science if they're not trained? And essentially, this is why these databases and these apps are so powerful, because they give us the science. They give us the science muscle without us really having to do much about it. So it's very important, and it's to the heart of trying to help nature to know exactly where it is when. So the bluebird bander is helping really figure out where those bluebirds go. And because when they die, people turn in the bird. And that's when the U.S. Geological Survey can look at the band and say, all right, we know where this bird received the band, and now we know where it died. So now we could get a sense of its life history and where it went during its lifetime. And so seeing where those bluebirds want to go and over what kind of time periods, you know, helps figure out their life cycle so that we can support them better. Now with iNaturalist, you take a photograph, and then that photograph gets uploaded onto something like a Facebook feed that people are looking at all over the world all the time. And a lot of experts are very eagerly looking at iNaturalist data. Because if you can imagine, they're getting all these free research assistants out there documenting the study subjects that they're so focused on. You know, one example is Greg Pauly, who's a PhD researcher at the LA Museum of Natural History. He's a herpetologist, and he's eagerly looking all day, basically, at iNaturalist feeds of reptiles and amphibians from Southern California. It's like he's got 2,000 research assistants out there taking pictures and making observations for him. And he is among the experts that can verify that that photograph is, yes, a western fence lizard, or no, it's probably something else. Mm-hmm. And if he sees something that he doesn't think really belongs where it's observed, he has a big question mark about that. He gets in his car and he goes and looks himself. And so that's sort of a big dimension of questioning people have about citizen science. But all science needs a lot of care and attention paid to the data collection. And citizen science is kind of no better or no worse than any other kind of science that way.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Mary Ellen Hannibal, author of Citizen Scientist, Searching for Heroes and Hope in an Age of Extinction. And to that point of connecting citizen science to data collections, we do have here at Boise State an Intermountain Bird Observatory. It's up in one of our foothills. And of course, they're banding birds every fall and every spring as they're coming up and down the Western Flyway. So any of our listeners who are looking for a way to get involved as far as birds is concerned, the Intermountain Bird Observatory is probably the place to go where you could get a very organized approach to your citizen science.
Well, I love that example. One of my favorite citizen science projects to participate in is the Hawk Watch at the Golden Gate Raptor Observatory here in the Bay Area. And our hawk migration, hawks are migrating south between the middle of August and the middle of November every year. And I've done this for 5 years. And, you know, each year, the whole process of it becomes more and more interesting to me. I get better and better at identifying the hawks. But, you know, I also start thinking about what I'm seeing. And when you're watching a bird migration, you know, you're watching the life history of these species that have done these trips, these journeys, for, in some cases, hundreds of thousands of years. You know, their ancestors did the same trip. So this really, I think, is a way to kind of better appreciate the long time history of evolution and to kind of understand our own place in it a little better than we usually do. It's hard to imagine the deep past, but these birds kind of bring us news of the deep past and how it is paying forward into the future. And in this era of, you know, many, many dire statements to make about nature, helping these creatures along their life ways is a very positive thing each one of us can do and feel really good about. You really are making a difference. You know, for example, Rachel Carson, she looked at the hawk mountain data on the East Coast. The hawk migration on the East Coast of the United States has been going for many more decades than the one here. And she noticed the hawk numbers going down. And she correlated that with DDT use, and then she wrote Silent Spring. So Silent Spring is essentially a book that is powered by citizen science. And there's an example of how citizen science can really have concrete outcomes in the world.
I would think from looking at your book and reading some of the examples, especially things like iNaturalist, and you mentioned the vast database that citizen scientists add to now in their work, that big data and the internet must be increasing dramatically the number of citizen scientists out there. I mean, I went onto the internet and I couldn't believe all the various opportunities I ran across. You didn't mention Zooniverse yet. You might want to tell us a little bit about that. But it sure looks to me like it's easier and easier for those of us interested in nature to get engaged instead of just standing by the wayside.
Well, that's a great example. So Zooniverse is something for people to go, you know, it's what a great name, right? Zooniverse. I just love that. Zooniverse is something you can actually do without leaving your home. So it's good for some people. And you can do it in addition, of course, to other ones that take you outside. And I, of course, advocate going outside. But Zooniverse has some great projects on it. And Zooniverse got started by actually asking citizens to look at pictures of the night sky to identify galaxies. So the human eye can recognize galaxies better than a computer can recognize galaxies because of the way they're shaped. And so they have all of this incredible, you know, night sky data from the Hubble telescope. They have so many images that they need interpreted, what's in those images. And citizen scientists have made tremendous contributions to what we understand about the universe, basically through that project of Zooniverse. Another one that I'm really keen on is called Floating Forests. That's another project of Zooniverse. And they are showing people satellite imagery off the West Coast because the human eye can tell which splotches in the water are kelp forests and which are probably something else. And again, the human eye does this better than the computer does. And we're having, you know, problems with kelp on the West Coast. We're losing kelp, and that's not good because kelp is like the forest. It's like the rainforest. It's habitat for many creatures. So where we are having trouble with kelp, we need to zoom in on that and figure out what we can do about it. So Zooniverse helps do that.
Well, didn't you help do something similar when it comes to sea stars down in California? And I think that was somehow related to the kelp issue.
Well, I wrote about it together because it all goes together. The C-STAR monitoring, I still do that project with the California Academy of Sciences. You know, the two projects that I do most are the C-STAR monitoring off Half Moon Bay near Santa Cruz here in California. And we go out when it's reasonable for people to be awake at the very lowest tides, because during some parts of the year, that's at 1 o'clock in the morning. But if it's at 5 o'clock in the morning to 5 o'clock at night, we go out about once or twice a month and we monitor these two plots. So we take these GPS points, we go to the same GPS point and pull our transect line around that and create a study site. And we monitor the creatures that are in it, and in particular sea stars, which you can call starfish. They actually are not a fish, they're an animal. So that's why sea star is sort of the more correct way to refer to them. But we all know them as starfish. And we monitor other creatures in the tide pool as well. We have these amazing nudibranchs here on the West Coast that are psychedelic little sea slugs, and they are just unbelievably colored and colorful. And their gastrointestinal fronds are sort of floating in the water. I mean, they're just crazy. They're very small, but they're very, very beautiful. And it's a big story in my book, because when I first started monitoring the sea stars, our plots were chosen because there was such a diversity of sea stars in them. There were 70 sea stars in our first plot in June 2012. By August 2012, there were zero. And what we're experiencing now on the West Coast is the single largest marine die-off known to human history. It's called the sea star wasting. And the sea star has a special place in the ecosystem. It has what's called a top-down forcing effect on the way the rest of the food chain goes in the tide pool. So it's sort of like a gigantic experiment going on, what happens when you take out the top predator. But nobody knows. We know that a virus has caused the sea stars to die off, but that we also know from citizen science collected data that the virus has been in the water for decades. So the question mark is, why is the virus affecting the sea stars now? And now all up and down the coast, again, this is a great example of needing citizen science, because just thousands of miles of coastline that are being monitored by professional and amateur counting projects and putting all that data together to get a sense of where is there maybe some recovery going on for the sea stars? Where are the juveniles recruiting? So that means, where do you see baby sea stars and where are they growing up? And so we go out there very keenly looking for those babies. And really, when we see a sea star out there now, we celebrate, we're so happy. But, there's not enough scientists in the world to monitor the coast of Western North America. You need all the eyes of lots and lots of people out there. And we all contribute in a way that makes something possible that otherwise would not be possible.
I would think that with the continuing decline in federal funding as far as academic research is concerned, that may also be making a difference in the importance and the impact of citizen science research.
Well, it's such a very, very important thing to bring up, Bob. So thank you for doing that. Because even if we were having good funding or a positive, receptive attitude toward science from our administration, which unfortunately we're not, we would still need to really step up our participation and our local questioning. Now, an important part of citizen science is for local people in communities, smaller communities, to ask very local questions that matter to you, and to go out there and observe with your own two eyes what's happening on our landscape that matters to us. And, you know, there's no amount of federal funding that's ever going to really address what's happening locally at such a scale that really then makes the connection between what citizens want for their community. You know, we get a little excited, I think, in citizen science about all the data we're collecting. Well, data is not going to save nature. We have to save nature. Data is our tool for saving nature, because we can take it to the county, to our supervisors, and we can say, look, the coho salmon run here in Maroon County, right here at this creek, has been going down, 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 because the building laws are allowing people to develop all the way up to the shoreline. And here we're going to show you data that when people build even 18 inches back from the shoreline, the coho salmon can get through. So we want you to change your ordinances so that people have to go 18 inches back from the creek side. And, you know, when people see it that way, even the developers are happy to make those changes because we all want to live with vibrant wildlife. And we can live with vibrant wildlife and still go about our business, but we need to be aware of what they need from the landscape as well. And citizen science is a way to get that data and frame those questions.
I'm Bob Custer, a host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Mary Ellen Hannibal, author of Citizen Scientist. The book explores how everyday Americans are contributing to scientific research. The subtitle of your book refers to the age of extinction, and in your book you use a number of examples. One in particular that came to mind for me is 1990. Scientists had a unique opportunity in Venezuela to study what happens to top predators when their habitat is fragmented. And I guess this brings up the whole issue of people thinking that, well, one extinction isn't so bad, as long as it doesn't grow and multiply. Well, the fact is that one extinction obviously has an enormous impact on other plant life and wildlife. And maybe the Venezuelan study is an example of that?
It's a great example of it, actually, because with that study, this was about jaguar, and that researcher is John Terborg, who's a very, very senior conservation biologist, and he's an expert in top predators. And the jaguar really gets the billing as the super top predator of them all. The jaguar is the most efficient killer, kills much more efficiently than wolves do, for example, and has that much more power than a mountain lion. But the top predator has what's called a forcing effect on the rest of the food chain. So what John Terborg did is he had an experiment that came about from the creation of this dam that created all of these little islands. It fragmented habitat. So where there had been landscape that was like a continuous jungle, suddenly there were just little islands surrounded by water. And on those islands, the species on them were isolated. They became trapped on those islands like monkeys, could not get off the island. And then there was no predator. The predator could not be on any of those islands because the top predators need really big, continuous landscapes to live on. So the jaguar just disappeared from that area. And then without the jaguar to control the number of monkeys, to eat some of the monkeys, there became too many monkeys. And then the monkeys, too many monkeys, started to eat all the greenery on their islands. So then the plants started to fight back, essentially, and put toxins into their leaves to try to survive because the monkeys were decimating the greenery. So the plants developed these toxins that poisoned the monkeys. I mean, the monkeys ended up starving. And this is what's kind of called the biotic unraveling. And that was a very dramatic example that really was a wonderful paradigm of what happens when you take a top predator off of an ecosystem, and also when you isolate little pieces of nature from each other. So today, you know, even in the United States, all over the place, we interrupt wildlife movement with our roadways and our buildings and our other human habitations. And a big effort, you know, you and I have talked before about my previous book, The Spine of the Continent, which is all about this concept of creating corridors or swaths of connectivity between big wild places so that plants and animals can move. Critical all over the United States to do that and to think that way.
I was going to ask you, how is the progress moving on the Spine of the Continent project?
Well, you know, it's really interesting, Bob. You know, it kind of ebbs and flows. The Spine of the Continent, just for listeners who might not know about it, is an effort to create linked landscapes all up and down the Rockies. And of course, that takes a lot of different stakeholders, a lot of different nonprofits and agency personnel and so forth in different states, you know, from Montana, Wyoming, Utah, New Mexico, Arizona. And today, you know what, we're getting a big assist in this from, I think, kind of a surprising species, and that is the monarch butterfly. So the monarch butterfly numbers are in a horrifying decline. We're losing about 35 to 45 million butterflies a year. It's pretty much that we see it's due to the use of Roundup by the big agriculture that has killed off so much of the butterfly's milkweed. But the monarch butterfly has a migration that goes all over the continental United States. It certainly goes up and down the spine of the continent. And because everybody recognizes this need to protect the monarch, there's been a historic agreement between Canada, the United States, and Mexico to work together across our national boundaries to help save the monarch butterfly. Now, when you protect connectivity for the monarch, actually, you protect it for a lot of other species as well, because what you're doing is protecting healthy habitat. Mm-hmm. So it turns out that if you protect really good habitat for monarchs in Mexico, guess who else is on the landscape suddenly there? Jaguar, because there's wonderful food supply, there's water, there's shade, there's just an abundance of biodiversity. So what's good for the monarch butterfly is good for a lot of other species. And I'm delighted because, you know, I talked to a jaguar biologist who was in the spine of the continent about a month ago, and he's working on monarch butterflies now. And I said, Sergio, you're a jaguar guy. And he said, I've gotten more conservation done in 3 months working on monarchs than I have in 15 years working on jaguars, because people are still scared of jaguars and ranchers still want to kill them. But he said, you know, even the biggest macho rancher gets a tear in his eye telling you about how he saw a monarch butterfly emerge from a chrysalis. You know, it's something very human and beautiful in a butterfly, and that we're not afraid of butterflies. And we can actually create habitat for butterflies in our own backyards by planting milkweed. We can see them. So it's really, thank you, butterfly. You're helping nature along immeasurably.
I think we have time for one more question, and I'd like to ask you about the role of the citizen scientist in impartial observation. The scientists which I work with here at Boise State University, needless to say, really have to be very objective in the work that they do. Oftentimes, I would think volunteers who come forth to help our science community are going to be advocates or partisans. How does that work? Is there a challenge on behalf of the scientific community in helping to educate citizen scientists so, in fact, they do approach their work with an objectivity that you wouldn't normally ask of somebody who's simply an advocate or a partisan?
I'm so glad that you're asking this question, because it really goes to the heart of one of the most powerful things about citizen science, when it's citizen science that is, again, an observation made with a smartphone or with a geolocating device and a camera, where you put the date, the time, the latitude, and the longitude with the observation. So now there's no advocacy about that, right? That's black and white. That is about as objective as you can get. And today, our even time is more precisely calibrated by the atomic clock. So our tools for precise location in time and space are profound. It's a profound difference, because even no matter how much a PhD scientist is trying not to be biased, we're all human and we don't even know our own biases. But if you look at data on a map, you see the pattern. And there might be some interpretation of that pattern, but then you also still have that pattern with these objective markers in it. But you suddenly have objective data that people can't really argue with. You have evidence. This is evidence.
That is a great way to conclude our interview, Mary Ellen. And again, thank you so much for writing the book, first of all, and coming on and talking with us here at Reader's Corner. Again, it's The Citizen Scientist, Searching for Heroes and Hope in an Age of Extinction. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Bob, and I really loved your questions. They were really great.
Mary Ellen Hannibal, thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Next week, John Dvorak, author of Mask of the Sun, The Science, History, and Forgotten Lore of Eclipses. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sienna Madrid. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. We invite you to follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook. Just search for Reader's Corner.